Turn back to our theme in Revelation 12, and we'll continue the study of this great chapter. Revelation, the 12th chapter. Last week we spent some time on the church in the wilderness in verse 6 and 14, and moved on down toward the end of the chapter. And for the time being, we passed over those verses which dealt with the war in heaven and the rise of the dragon, that old serpent called the devil and Satan. Turn back now and read those verses, verse 7 down to verse 12. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Now I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now is come salvation and strength, and the kingdom of our God, and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. Now, we'll say at the beginning, of course, that in these verses we have a tremendous area of study, an area of study which we've dealt with fairly conclusively in the past, in the several occasions when we've taken up the series from The Spirit of the Papacy by E.T. Jones, which dealt with the origin of evil. And much as this is a favourite theme of mine, and I never tire of going over and over the beginnings of the great controversy, inasmuch as we have dealt with this thoroughly in the past, I don't propose to take up in the detail we might the study of the beginning of the great controversy as it took place back up there in heaven. I would say this, however, that every Seventh-day Adventist, every believer in the present message, should make themselves very, very familiar with the way in which that great controversy began up there in the kingdom of heaven. The reasons for this are brought to view in this chapter very, very clearly and distinctly. The struggles which go on in the world today, those which took place back in John's day, those which were foretold through him of the great battle of the Middle Ages, are not separate and divided battles differing from the great controversy itself. Rather, they are but the continuation of the same controversy fought over the same issues with the same principal characters involved. In this connection, I'd like to draw your attention to a statement found in the book Great Controversy, where we are told this very thing, page 582. From the very beginning of the great controversy in heaven, it has been Satan's purpose to overthrow the law of God. It was to accomplish this that he entered upon his rebellion against the Creator. And though he was cast out of heaven, he has continued the same warfare upon the earth. I want to pause right there a moment and just comment upon those words so far to note what they have to say. And the more one studies the Word of God, the more one realizes the absolute truth of the words which have been expressed in this paragraph. From the very beginning of the great controversy in heaven, it has been Satan's purpose to overthrow the law of God. Now note this, from the very beginning of the great controversy, that was Satan's purpose. In other words, the controversy did not begin over one point and then deviate and develop into something else. It began over this one great issue, the overthrow of God's law, and it has continued from that point. It was to accomplish this that he entered upon his rebellion against the Creator. And though he was cast out of heaven, he has continued the same warfare upon the earth. And that word same, it means not a different warfare, but one which is identical with the original one. To deceive men and thus lead them to transgress God's law is the object which he has steadfastly pursued. Now, we're going to deal, of course, a little further with Satan as the great deceiver, which is especially mentioned for us there in the 9th verse, he deceiveth the whole world. But for the moment, I want you to notice this word deceive here, where it says to deceive men and thus lead them to transgress God's law. is the object which he has steadfastly pursued. In other words, Satan desires to make every man a lawbreaker, both in nature and in deed and in fact. Of course, as we have stressed in studies in the past, and I'll just briefly allude to this morning, one of Satan's great deceptions, in fact possibly his greatest deception, is the argument that God's law is too difficult for a human being to obey, that it is impossible for us to keep that law. I won't take time right now, read you statement after statement from the book Great Controversy, Desire of Ages, and refer you back to the story of Job once again, to show how that this is what Satan desires to do. And we recognize the fact, of course, that there are various means by which he seeks to accomplish this purpose, and possibly modern religion, well, I wouldn't say possibly, certainly, modern religion is Satan's greatest ally in this warfare against the law of God. In the first case, of course, the Catholic and Protestant churches teach that the first day of the week is the day to be kept in preference to the seventh day, and as we've been plainly warned, to break one of those Ten Commandments is to break them all. So by substitution, by the bringing of one day in the place of another, Satan is very successful in deceiving men into the transgression of God's law. But closer home still is the argument that the law cannot be kept by human beings, that perfection of character and perfection of life is an impossibility. And of course, in taking up this position, those who do so teach that Jesus Christ, when he came to this earth, came in the sinless perfection of the first Adam. Denying the great teaching of Wagner and Jones, the spirit of prophecy in the Bible, that Jesus Christ came in the same flesh and blood as the children, he was God in the fullness of all that God was, dwelling in flesh, sinful flesh, in the fullness of all that sinful flesh is today and was back at that time. And thus living as divinity in humanity, he proved for every one of us that the law could be kept by any man, in any age, in any place, to perfection. This is the witness of the life of Christ, and the very purpose as to why that life was lived upon this earth. Satan, of course, recognizing the tremendous argument provided in the life of Christ, deceives men into believing that Christ was no example for them, that he substitutes his obedience in place of their obedience, and thus removes from man the need to obey on his own behalf. This is Satan's purpose, and this is Satan's work, and modern religion, as I mentioned a moment ago, is his greatest ally in the deceiving of men into law-breaking. I read further, whether this be accomplished by casting aside the law altogether or by rejecting one of its precepts, the result will be ultimately the same. He defends in one point manifest contempt for the whole law. His influence and example are on the side of transgression. He becomes guilty of all. In seeking to cast contempt upon the divine statutes, Satan has perverted the doctrines of the Bible, and errors have thus become incorporated into the faith of thousands who profess to believe the Scriptures, which of course is what I was saying just a few moments ago. And note this next sentence, which says, the last great conflict between truth and error is but the final struggle of the long-standing controversy concerning the law of God. Note that, the last great conflict between truth and error. And this, of course, is something which is very, very close now to us, the great battle of Armageddon, the final conflict between the powers of darkness and the powers of righteousness. Now, this final struggle is not a political battle between Eastern and Western nations to be fought out on some obscure plain in the Middle East. It is the final struggle of the long-standing controversy concerning the law of God. Upon this battle we are now entering, a battle between the laws of men and the precepts of Jehovah, between the religion of the Bible and the religion of fable and tradition. Now I read this paragraph to emphasize the thought that right down to the entire span of Bible history, there is only one theme. It is the great controversy between Christ and Satan. We don't have a particular controversy for one age and a different one for a different age. True, the particular emphasis on a particular point may vary from age to age. For instance, during the last 10 to 15 years in particular, Well, in Adventist circles, it's been the controversy over the nature of Christ. Did he come in holy flesh or sinful flesh? Earlier, it was the battle over the Sabbath, and will be the battle over the Sabbath again. But when you get behind the facade of the external point which is being controverted, to the foundation of that controverted point, it still comes back to the great question of Christian perfection and obedience to the law of God. I note with interest the statement there in the book of Daniel chapter 10, where Daniel was told by the angel as he was about to unfold the revelations of the 11th chapter that he would tell him that which was noted in the scripture of truth. And as we go back into Jeremiah, into Isaiah, and to Genesis, we find there the same powers, the same controversy in Daniel 11 as we find in those earlier places. I don't have time, of course, to develop this particular thought this morning, much as I would like to do so. Now, with that picture in mind, we can come back and look again at the structure of the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation. It opened, as you recall, with the woman, which is the church of God, about to be delivered of the man-child, which was Jesus Christ. And standing before the woman was this great red dragon, which was there to devour the child as soon as it was delivered. But the child escaped the dragon's power, was caught up to God into heaven, and there sat on God's right hand upon his throne. The woman leapt upon this church, then felt the ire of the dragon, and she fled for her life to a prepared place in the wilderness where she was nourished for 1,260 days. Now John, looking on, sees three characters in particular in this particular battle. He sees the man-child, Jesus Christ, against whom he has been in controversy from the very beginning of this great battle. He sees the woman, which is the church of God upon this earth, who is the church, which is the church that God nourishes and cares for, and through whom he expresses his will and through whom he fights his battles upon this earth. And then, of course, he sees the dragon, that old serpent called the devil and Satan. And as John looks upon this fearful struggle, this terrible battle, then the Lord lets that scene fade from view and takes his mind right back to that point of time when there began to be a war in heaven, and traces through that battle and the outcome of it and the results right down until John's own time. And then again picks up the picture of the woman and carries that picture on to its end with the remnant church and what that remnant church is said to possess. Now this is something unusual in Bible prophecy, because generally speaking, Bible prophecy starts with the present tense and carries your view from that on through succeeding rising powers down to the end of time. But here we have a flashback which takes us clear back to the very beginning of the great controversy. And this is necessary in order to show to John and to you and to me the fact that the controversy which is going on today is not something different, not something new, not something which was not there before, but something which is but a continuation of that original controversy. Now this is why Solomon, speaking back there in the book of Ecclesiastes, said to us that there's nothing new under the sun. Let's just go back there a moment today and read those verses where he says this. I'll read first of all chapter 1 and verse 9, where Solomon says, "The thing that hath been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun." Now, of course, there may be new inventions, there may be new books put out, but what Solomon's concerned with, of course, is the great controversy and the issues involved in that. Then we turn to the third chapter and read verse 15. "That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past." So those things of the past have been repeated right down here in our present time. Now you know, when something comes to us which has never happened before, something which is completely unknown in the past, something which for the first time appears amongst us, then we are caught by surprise. And we do not know how to cope with this new problem because it's something foreign to our past experience. But when that which comes upon us today is something which has taken place in the past, and we are very familiar with that which took place in the past, especially if it's been in our own experience, then what about our relationship to this problem? It's much more simple, isn't it? We are now prepared for it. We should know and possibly do know how to cope with it and can deal with it with much more confidence and with certainty than if this thing was utterly and entirely new. And inasmuch then as the battleground upon which we're now entering is but the continuation of this long-standing controversy between good and evil, it follows then that the better we understand the origin of this conflict, the better we understand just how Satan's mind developed as it did, the better we understand just what he aimed to do, the better we understand how he was able to deceive the angels into following him, the better we understand the distinction between Satan's purposes and the principles of God's kingdom, then the better equipped we're going to be to face the great battle which is soon to burst upon this earth. And therefore, if we have not already become thoroughly familiar with the rise of evil, then let's take Jones's book, The Spirit of the Papacy, and read it through with meticulous care, prayerful care, not once, nor twice, but many times. And take likewise the third chapter of the book of Genesis and study that very, very carefully. Take likewise a chapter in Patriarchs and Prophets entitled "The Why Was Sin Permitted?" and the chapter in Great Controversy called The Origin of Evil. And really study these until we grasp the legal implications of the Great Controversy in all those points I mentioned in regard to Satan's activities and in respect to God's response to it. And then we shall be the better equipped to face the great deceiver as he comes against us in these last days. I mentioned the word great deceiver. I'll turn your mind again to verse 9, which says, "And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." The mystery of iniquity lies in the fact that Satan, who was a perfect angel, the one who stood nearest to God and therefore had the opportunity of knowing the most about God, who lived in a perfect environment among millions of wonderfully happy angels, could succeed in that situation in deceiving them into believing that he had a case, to the point where one third of the angelic host followed him entirely and completely. Now when you think about it, that is something, because for a being in heaven where everything is going so perfectly, to be able to make the angels feel dissatisfied with what they had and long for something different and otherwise, to come to the place where they believed that God had given them everything they had, was their enemy and their oppressor, well, the more you think about it, the more you wonder how Satan could ever have possibly been successful in that kind of operation and activity. But the facts are, he was. He was successful. And one third of the angels cast in their lot with him, to the point where two parties with very distinctly drawn lines are formed up there in heaven. When those two parties had been formed, the time came when a confrontation was inevitable, and there came a battle or a warfare between these two groups. And of course, with the power of God on one side and with two-thirds of the angels pitted against one-third, Satan was not able to maintain his position. He was cast out of heaven and his place was found there no more at all. He can, and up until the crucifixion of Christ, of course, reigned through the universe and used to wait the angels at the gates of God and tempt them as Desire of Ages 7:6-1, I think it is, tells us he did. Now, we then, however, can begin to appreciate the power of that mastermind as a deceiver. And to bear in mind that we today find ourselves pitted against that mastermind. In the Great Controversy again, we have a very, very chilling warning, I may use that word, in respect to Satan's activities, both in heaven and upon this earth. I read here from page 9 and 10 of the introduction, where it says, "The great controversy will between good and evil will increase in intensity to the very close of time. In all ages, the wrath of Satan has been manifested against the Church of Christ, and God has bestowed his grace and spirit upon his people to strengthen them to stand against the power of the evil one. When the apostles of Christ were to bear his gospel to the world and to record it for all future ages, they were especially endowed with the enlightenment of the Spirit. But as the church approaches her final deliverance, Satan is to work with greater power. He comes down having great wrath because he knows that he hath but a short time. He'll work with all power and signs and lying wonders. 2 Thessalonians 2:9. For 6,000 years, that mastermind that was once highest among the angels of God has been wholly bent to the work of deception and ruin. And all the depths of satanic skill and subtlety acquired, all the cruelty developed during those struggles of the ages, will be brought to bear against God's people in the final conflict. In other words, when Satan deceived the angels, he was still only an apprentice in the work of deception. He was still only a novice. He was only a mere beginner. That was 6,000 years ago. And during those 6,000 years, the beginner has matured. The novice has become experienced. The apprentice has become a full technician. And if the apprentice, the beginner, and the novice have the power to deceive mighty angels in the perfect environment of heaven, then how much more careful we need to be today, lest we likewise be deceived. Because in these last days, this same devil, this same serpent, this same dragon is to come down with great wrath, knowing how but a short time to deceive and to lead astray the people of God. Turn now to page 574 in the book Counsels on Health, where we have a very impressive statement, as I thought it was as we read it this morning, which shows that what Satan will do so far as deceiving the Church of God is concerned. Just pick it up here. Yes. It speaks about the controlling power of appetite and the danger of that, and says the appetite and passion should be restricted and under the control of enlightened conscience, that the intellect may be unimpaired. The perceptive power is clear, and note what follows. So that the workings of Satan and his snares may not be interpreted to be the providence of God. And note that. We are to keep our appetites and passions under strict control, so that the intellect may be unimpaired, the perceptive powers clear, so that the workings of Satan and his snares may not be interpreted to be the providence of God. You know, today, Satan is working to make his work appear to be God's work. And thousands upon thousands, nay, millions of people are being deceived by Satan in this respect, until they call the work of Satan the work of God and the work of God the work of Satan. For instance, just to mention an instance very briefly, I possibly mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again today in case some who were not here didn't hear it the last time. An example of the way in which the work of Satan has been interpreted to be the providence of God is given to us in the history of the churches just prior to 1888. Let's go back now and just reiterate very briefly what took place in 1844. A tremendous test of truth came to the churches of that day. And when I say a test of truth, the test which determined their future so far as their relationship to God was concerned. And when the vast majority refused to accept the first and second angel's messages, or the first angel's message, I should best say, then what did that vast majority become? Babylon. The second angel, following the first, declared, Babylon is fallen. In the Great Controversy, page 389, we're given a very clear rule whereby we can identify who Babylon is. I'll just turn to the statement and read it for you, because it's very, very clear in this respect. Page 389 in the book Great Controversy. The second angel's message of Revelation 14 was first preached in the summer of 1844, then had a more direct application to the churches of the United States, where the warning of the judgment had been most widely proclaimed and most generally rejected, and where the declension in the churches had been most rapid. But the message of the second angel did not reach its complete fulfillment in 1844. And note these next words. The churches then experienced a moral fall in consequence of their refusal of the light of the Advent message. But that fall was not complete. And just to illustrate this, perhaps
briefly today. The churches were proceeding. To them came the testing truths of the great second advent message, and because of the rejection of those truths, they suffered a moral fall.
As they have continued to reject the special truths for this time, they have fallen lower and lower. Now, what are the special truths for this time? The Sabbath, nature of Christ, the sanctuary, the great judgment, our message, the spirit of prophecy, and so on. The non-immortality of the soul too. So, as we find a body of people today who reject those special truths, where must we strictly categorize them as being Babylon? Strictly. Now, true, there may be individuals in those churches which do not, which are God's true children, but we're concerned here with the movement as such. Now, God warned these people that in these fallen churches there would be manifest a remarkable power which would look like the power of God, in which ministers would stand up who did not believe the special truths for this time, and who would convert thousands upon thousands of people to their churches. The Advent folk were warned that this would happen. And yet, when there arose a man by the name of D.L. Moody, whose ministry began in around about 1860 or 17, and continued on toward the end of the 19th century, that man came to be hailed by Seventh-day Adventists as a great man of God. But I ask you this, how could he be? Did he believe in any one of the special truths of this time? Not one. Who was he? He was a young Babylonian preacher who preached in Babylonian churches the doctrines of Babylon to build up Babylon to the end of his day. Is that what the men of God do? Absolutely not. That was the prophesied power and work of Satan going forward, and yet tens of thousands of Seventh-day Adventists declare that to be the work of God. And Satan, of course, is well pleased, very well pleased. Now, the story goes, I'll make that a little further, that one day a preacher said to his audience, the world is yet to see what God can do in and for and through and by the man who is wholly consecrated to him. And young Moody was in the audience, and young Moody said, by God's grace, I'll be that man. And that, of course, is a very impressive consecration, as you can well imagine. So then, in response to this challenge, so the stories go, this young man was filled with the power of God and would have to spend a powerful life preaching in the Babylonian churches until the end of his days. Now, if God did go and work through D.L. Moody, then God is a very capricious and a very unreliable God. Let's take, for instance, a man like James White, who is up here in the Great Second Advent movement. And let me ask you this question. Can you think of any man who is more consecrated to God than James White? I couldn't. He was a man who was wholly dedicated to God's service. Furthermore, God commissioned James White, along with the rest of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, to go forth and declare that the fallen Protestant churches were Babylon, and to warn that there would arise ministers in those churches who would apparently be filled with the power of God. Now, I could take early writings and Great Controversy and other documents written back in those days and read their warnings given by God through his prophet that the very things that Moody did would be done. Very good. So then we find that God then called James White and commissioned him, along with other Adventists, to declare that Babylon had fallen and to warn against the rise of this very kind of minister. And then one day God hears young Moody's dedication, and he's so delighted, so the story would tell us, that he forgets all about the commission given to James White and to the other Adventists, and he goes over into Babylon and fills out Babylon with all the power you could imagine to preach Babylon's doctrines, to build up Babylon to the end of his days. Is that the kind of God we serve? Absolutely not. God is reliable. God is not capricious, and God is not caught by surprise. When God gave a commission to James White, then God stood by it. The work of D.L. Moody absolutely fulfilled every prophesied specification of a false prophet. Now, I'm not today judging Moody's character or his motives or anything else. We're only concerned with whether that man was a man of God or not. Now, some folk will say you can't judge a man. Moody was a man of God. You can't say he wasn't. Those people who declare him to be a man of God are likewise judging him because they've also made a declaration in regard to him. As we come down to the end of time, as Christ warned there in Matthew 24, there would arise many false Christs and many false prophets, and what must we do with these men? We must try them. We must test them And we must keep, as it says here in Council on Health, page 574, must keep the intellect unimpaired, the perceptive powers clear, so that the workings of Satan, his snares, may not be interpreted to be the providences of God. This is one of our greatest dangers. Let's learn to recognize the working of God to be the working of God, and the working of Satan to be the working of Satan. Don't trust your senses, don't trust what your eyes see, or what your ears hear. Rather, let's take these men back to what the Word of God says and test them by those means. In other words, it's quite simple. Whenever we see in the world today a man like Billy Graham, if you wish, Dr. Orr, Oral Roberts, or any of these men who arise and preach with tremendous power, working undeniable miracles, just ask yourself this simple question. Do these men uphold and proclaim the special truths for this time, or do they not? If they do, then by whose power do they preach? God's power. If they do not, then by whose power do they preach? Satan's power. It's as simple as that. Let's not be deceived, because Satan is the great deceiver, and he'll go on deceiving right down until the very end. The battle is not yet finished. The same issues are yet to be climaxed and finalized. And I do trust that as we come on toward the end, that we shall come out on the right side of the great controversy. May God bless us, each one to this end, is my prayer today.